Good morning.
Members of the court, it's my distinct pleasure to introduce Joel Perwin, who will be arguing on behalf of the appellants, and James Farrar, who is lead trial attorney below. Mr. Simple, I believe, will make some introductions also.
Morning.
I'd like to introduce the members of the defense team who have participated in the brief and have been in the product, BJ Michael Martinez, Barry Parson, and William Anderson of Crowell and Mooring. I will be making the argument on behalf of the defendant.
Good morning to all of our guests. Welcome to the court. May it please the court. After a little over 8 years of litigation in these cases, we are here on two questions concerning specific causation, as opposed to the far more expansive consideration of general causation in these cases, in which our overall thesis is that Judge Tolliver's decision, respectfully, is far outside of the mainstream of decision-making interpreting the Daubert decision on the issue of specific jurisdiction, which exceeds the compatibility of those threshold gatekeeping functions prescribed by Daubert on the one hand and the sanctity of the jury system on the other, and the principle that when expert testimony is in conflict, it is juries which should resolve that testimony. We have offered, in contrast, the very recent decision of Judge Sleitz in the asbestos case, the decision of Judge Quillen in the Minner case, which we believe is a far more appropriate paradigm for balancing those two competing factors. I'm going to discuss them in specifics, but to illustrate the overall argument, let me just run through them very quickly. One, on the question of whether an expert, in this case Dr. Howard, can be qualified not simply on the basis of his training or on the basis of the diploma which he has on his wall, but also on the basis of his experience in analyzing both genetic and environmental factors. The issues and the authorities are thoroughly settled. They represent the overwhelming majority of decisions, not just here, but all over the nation. And they're summarized at page 11 of our brief. On the issue of how to apply what's called a differential diagnosis, which is a methodology both sides acknowledge to be valid and to be acceptable, to the extent that it requires consideration of alternatives other than that advanced by the expert, and how one integrates those two considerations, the plaintiff's position is supported by an overwhelming body of authority, which I'm going to talk about. We've cited cases from the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the District of Columbia Circuit, Delaware Superior Court decisions, Florida Supreme Court decisions, and numerous lower court decisions on the extent to which Dr. Howard could state his opinion on the issue of causation, incorporating any consideration of genetic factors well within the rubrics established by the Daubert decision. Overwhelming majority consideration. And finally, on the questions of the minimal prerequisites for validating a methodology, in this case, the Potsky methodology, which was utilized by Dr. McIntosh to establish specific causation in this case, the overwhelming authority, and once again, and I'm sorry to be so extreme in this, but the absolutely established authority that the predicates which we offered concerning the reliability of that methodology are so clearly established that, respectfully, it was not a close question. That
your opponent cites at least two other cases where Dr. Howard was not allowed to testify. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. They were cases in which the issue was general causation as opposed to specific causation. And they were cases in which the Bourne decision, Third Circuit, is most prominent, in which the environment, factual and regulatory environment, in which he expressed his opinion was significantly different from the one that had evolved at the time of his decision in this case. And I would just state in contrast that there are numerous decisions in which Dr. Howard has been qualified to testify. And, of course, every case is record specific. And in particular, I mean, there was no application of the Potsky model in the Bourne litigation. The European Chemicals Bureau, the ACB, had not yet announced its seminal decision on the teratological effect of benlate and Benamil. The New Jersey finding had not been issued. The EPA rating, which was echoed by NIOSH, had not been issued. The California EPA warning had not been issued. All of those factual, and by not been issued, I mean not introduced into evidence. Some of them had happened, but they weren't part of the evidence in that case. I want to be accurate here.
Well, help me understand part of the record. Once this CHD7 mutation became apparent, and then Dr. Howard wanted to continue, according to your briefs, to say that benlate could be a cause, and notwithstanding the existence of this mutation. And what was the basis for his opinion to that effect? It ties into the differential diagnosis argument, but where do we see the ability to replicate that conclusion, or what's the factual support for his opinion that notwithstanding the existence of this mutation, we've got another proximate cause also?
Yes, Your Honor, and a necessary proximate cause, without which we either would not have had these symptoms or we would not have had as extreme symptoms, which we believe is entirely consonant with Delaware law. And there are a number of factors. Let me tick them off and then go back. There is the general established association between genetic and environmental factors, which we've talked about at pages 12 to 14, 23 to 27 of the main brief, and 9 to 15 of the reply brief. There is the analog between those relationships and the relationship between genetic causes and the charge symptom itself, as opposed to the CHD7 mutation. There is the weak evidence concerning the causative impact of a CHD7 mutation. And there is evidence in Emily's particular case which parallels those precise factors, that there is weak evidence of the mutation being a causative factor in her case, and there is strong evidence of the causative influence of the benlate. And I would submit, Your Honor, that respectfully, this is a red herring. The interaction between environmental and genetic causes is established. It is established by our studies, and it is perfectly established by DuPont's studies. Take, for example, the Staples report, the rat studies. Not all of the rats who were administered the same dosage had the same manifestations or symptoms.
And do you agree with the representations concerning the dosages, which seem like a lot? Is that what the rats really were subjected to?
Yes, they were. Not only were they subjected to minimal dosages compared to the dosages that the mothers in this case were exposed to, according to the plaintiff's evidence, but they were subjected to dosages which were comparable to far lesser human dosages, which would have had the same manifestation. And in these studies, those manifestations, the effects which they had, became increasingly severe as the dosages increased, which tells us from the initial findings that not every genetic condition ended up in the causation of symptoms. Not every application of chemicals ended up in the symptoms themselves, and the dosages themselves increased the effects. That means there has to be an interaction between environmental and genetic factors. It's got to be.
Is your argument that the Superior Court in this case abused its discretion in its application of Daubert, or that it misapplied Daubert, so it would be more analogous to some type of legal error?
I think I have to admit that it misapplied Daubert to these facts. I think it gave, in terms of stating the general rubric, it stated the law. But it overapplied that law, failing to recognize that we are talking about a minimal gatekeeping function here, and that Dr. McIntosh, by virtue of what I've just said and what I'm about to say, very easily established that minimum by explaining the interaction between the genetic condition in this case, which created a condition for these environmental factors, and in fact may well have enhanced them, and the necessary environmental causes, the benlate exposure, which was massive in this case, which ultimately produced this these effects, or at least effects which were these severe.
Let me just backtrack for a minute. I know you've been addressing this issue, but isn't it, at the risk of oversimplification, we know that both of these children had CHARGE syndrome.
No, only one.
Only one. All right.
Yes, Your Honor. Only one parent had the mutation, and
all
this
right.
argument only relates to one.
Okay. As to that one, the issue, if I understand it right, is whether CHARGE syndrome can be caused, is caused exclusively by the mutated gene, or whether it is or can be caused by a combination of a genetic mutation influenced also by benlate or other environmental factors.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your theory is the latter.
Our evidence
yes.
is the yes. Our evidence is the latter.
Well, it's your theory that would be subject to the Daubert scrutiny, would it not?
No, Your Honor. It would be the acceptability
I'm
of
sorry,
the methodology which establishes that theory. The underlying...
Okay, we're you're quibbling.
Semantic. Okay, go ahead.
We're talking
yes.
about a scientific approach. I call it a theory.
Yes. The answer is yes.
All right. And for the court below to have ruled the way it did, it had to have found that there was and could be only one cause of CHARGE syndrome, and that you contend is error.
It is accepted.
Because it excluded, what exactly was the error?
The error was accepting one side's expert and rejecting the others. It was agreeing with their side that it had to be the exclusive cause and simply rejecting our side, which said not only was it not the exclusive cause, but the environmental exposure was a necessary cause based on what I said was the evidentiary support. I mean, look what happens in the Visser study, which was their paradigm. You had 49 of 70 people in the study which had the condition but not the mutation. You had people in the study which had the mutation but not the condition. You had absolutely no control to decide what environmental factors there were that could have produced this condition in these individuals. It was, and to base the court's finding by saying, I believe this and I don't believe Howard, we submit was an accession of the standard. Maybe that's an error of law, because the question is only, did Dr. Howard correctly apply a differential diagnosis to explain why the environmental factors in this case had to be a prevailing cause? And look at the evidence which he, and incidentally, that was his testimony. He said at A0279, referring to the Williams article on Visser, quote, the evidence presented does not allow the conclusion that haploinsufficiency, which is part of the CHD7 mutation, of CHD7 is sufficient by itself to cause the CHARGE phenotype. He said at A0169 that it is unquestionable at the least that the condition in this case of this young girl would not have been nearly as severe, without the environmental exposure of her mother. She was saturated
at critical times in the development of the fetus. She had five times the exposure which is necessary to cause cell death. And this was against a massive quantity of literature and testing. Every kind of testing you can imagine, except what they say we needed to do, which was inject this chemical into pregnant mothers and risk hurting them or killing their fetuses, that could possibly be done. We cited cases.
Can I interrupt there, because there seems to be a factual issue on this point. Is it your position that there were no studies for calculating dermal absorption that Dr. Howard could have used?
Right. You can't do it. You can't, respectfully, Your Honor, you can't measure what happened to somebody in the past after it's washed off and you don't have measurable quantities. And we're moving now to the second argument. You understand? We're moving now to Dr. McIntosh and the pot sky argument, and that's perfect for me because that's where I was going. You can't do it. And the issue was whether, not all of the micro challenges to the pot sky application that we've heard from the other side. The issue, and the only issue, was whether the methodology is generally accepted. And I submit that the evidence on that is simply overwhelming. And I submit that's the only question. We have introduced evidence. Look at pages 16 to 17 of the brief. Same pages, incidentally, in the reply brief. It was peer-reviewed, which is their criterion. It is validated by substantial scientific literature. It is widely used. It is chosen by the Environmental Protection Agency as a valid methodology. It is chosen by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, recommended as the appropriate methodology. It is validated by Dr. Sauerhoff and Tackett, who were not challenged, I believe. And that is our only question. Is it an acceptable methodology, given that acceptance of DuPont's argument means it always wins? It always wins if you buy that argument. Then the question is it an adequate methodology for measuring, based on exposure figures, the amount of absorption? Excuse me. And it's done through the application of models created and sanctioned by the EPA, which are tested against measurable, measured exposures in real life. Those numbers.
A moment. You've covered the clock. You have 3 minutes of your total time left.
I'm into my rebuttal.
Yes, you
are. I'll stop and submit and reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Sullivan, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. I'm here on behalf of DuPont. I'm James Semple. I noticed that my adversary referred to the minimal gatekeeping function. Well, I mean, I think it seems to me that the Supreme Court cases which this Court has adopted in the Lebeau decision authored by Justice Holland and the progeny of those cases, it makes very clear that gatekeeping function is a very important one. And this Court has admonished trial courts to fulfill that function and has examined the whether that function is fulfilled several times since the Lebeau decision and makes very clear that the standard of review is an abuse of discretion, which, as I understand it, means that the trial court has tremendous latitude to look at the evidence on whether or not this expert's qualified, whether the methodology used is reliable, whether the result bears a reasonable relationship to the underlying data. And the question isn't whether or not another judge or another court would agree with that decision, but whether or not there's a reasonable basis to support that decision and whether it's been exercised in good faith and according to the appropriate standards. Now, we heard today, and we saw in the briefs, nothing to suggest that Judge Tolliver did not apply the appropriate standards. He enumerated and articulated those standards.
Mr. Semple, in order for us to uphold Judge Tolliver's decision, on the issue of specific causation, the first issue, wouldn't we have to find or uphold his finding that there can be no other cause of CHARGE syndrome except genetic cause?
Now, I'm sort of good at getting ahead of myself, but I wouldn't do that if I could.
Go to that.
Dr. Howard's opinion that is at issue in this case is not the same opinion that it was issued in 2003.
But what we're interested in is the argument you made to Judge Tolliver. Is it your position and was it your expert's position that if you have this CHD7 mutation, that there can be no other cause?
Well, I was just about to review the evidence on that, if I could.
That's a yes or no.
Was that your position? You can explain it, but what Justice Jacobs and I both want to know is, was that your position, that if you have the CHD7 mutation, that is the sole cause of CHARGE syndrome?
If Judge Tolliver was justified in determining that all of the geneticists that have testified in this case and provided a scientific opinion based upon reasonable medical certainty have all testified that CHD7 explains all the symptoms of Emily Bowen. And what happened, if I get back to where I was going so you can understand why I'm saying that, Dr. Howard's original opinion was that Benadryl caused these effects. They were the same effects in 2003 as they were in 2005.
Well, we know there was a change in the scientific state of the art.
Right, and the basis for that decision at that time, his differential diagnosis, was he was relying upon Dr. Patton to rule out genetics as a cause.
Okay, well, we now know that genetics is a cause. The question is it the only cause, yes or no? That is
not
your position.
Our position substantively is that it is not, but that is not the issue before Judge Tolliver. The issue before Judge Tolliver, he was not deciding specific, he wasn't deciding proximate causation. This is where they sort of conflate concurrent causation with the Daubert analysis. The Daubert analysis comes first. You never get to proximate causation. If they can prove proximate causation, then the jury could be instructed on concurrent causes. But the issue before this court is whether or not there was sufficient evidence and whether Judge Tolliver abused his discretion in finding that these experts did not meet Daubert criteria. Now, to do that, everybody admits you need a differential diagnosis.
I'm not talking about the experts. I'm asking a question about the theory or methodology.
The theory of Dr. Howard had been that Benadryl causes all the effects. It depended upon a geneticist ruling out a genetic cause.
You're talking about the history. I'm now talking about his position post.
His position post is now that there's some interaction between Benadryl and CHD7. And in order to make that determination, you need to come to genetic analyses and genetic determinations and give genetic opinions, and he doesn't have that. We listed in our brief a litany of genetic opinions that he gave, and Judge Tolliver...
So it may be the case. You're willing to concede that it may be the case that CHARGE syndrome can be specifically caused by an interaction between genetic makeup or an altered genetic makeup and Benlate.
No, really
but,
or not.
Dr. Howard wasn't the guy to get that evidence before the court. Is that?
There's no one in the history of the world or the history of science who has ever posited that theory except Dr. Howard, and there is no evidence in the scientific literature anywhere, any place, any time that makes that connection. All the geneticists who testified in this case under Rose and gave an opinion said that's the case. Say that there is no, CHD7 explains all the symptoms and that they're not aware of any basis for saying that Benadryl or any other teratogen for that matter and CHD7 cause this. In fact, Dr. Howard himself.
So based on the evidence of record, your position is the CHD7 gene, the mutated gene, is necessary and sufficient in and of itself to cause CHARGE syndrome.
That's correct. In fact, it's interesting,
And any theory of interaction between the mutated gene and Benlate or any other environmental factor is at least based on the current state of the art, undemonstrated and wouldn't pass muster under.
That's correct, and that's what, and that's
no matter who articulated it.
At this point, that's correct. But Dr. Howard, for example, admitted also that charge does not cause. I mean, rather that Benadryl does not cause charge syndrome. He also admitted. In all cases that Genesis has also testified, in all cases in which there is a CHD7 mutation and charge, the mutation alone is sufficient to cause it. And there was a misstatement in my opponent's opening statement. We talked about 49 out of 70 had a condition but not the mutation. That's not true. The VISRA study pointed out that 49 out of 70 had both the mutation and charge. That's what the VISRA study said. In addition, curiously enough, there was one person among those in these studies who was born before Benlate ever came on the market, and one who was born after Benlate was no longer on the market. But
there were 21 test subjects who did not have the mutated gene who had charge. Correct?
Well, it's somewhat correct, and we can get into real quibbles, but I think the issue that's important before us is that on the current state of this record, which is what Judge Tolliver was looking at, every geneticist who expressed an opinion expressed the opinion that I just articulated.
I thought the Fisher study was part of the current state of this record.
It is correct. And my
doesn't that study show that it's possible to get, that is, to contract charge syndrome without genetics, without a mutated gene?
Well, without the CHD7 gene, there are other specific genes that are associated with charge. There are also most geneticists think that the charge is have thought this for years, that it's caused by a genetic problem, even though you can't identify the specific gene. So those are possibilities. It's also some of those people had symptoms or characteristics which might give rise to some charge association. But there does appear to be some universe, a rather small one. The majority are 49 out of 70. The scientists think that's persuasive evidence.
Your characterization of the record is that the only methodology or theory of specific causation that has been peer-reviewed is the theory that the sole specific causative factor of charge syndrome is genetic.
That's right? True. But
And to the extent there's a theory out there that charge syndrome can be caused by a combination of genetics and Benlate or some other environmental agent, that has not been peer-reviewed.
That's correct. And the focus of this appeal is whether or not, again, Judge Tolliver abused his discretion in finding that Dr. Howard was using a reliable methodology, whether he was qualified to offer essentially genetic opinions, because he's talking about how a gene, which he admitted he never heard of until the VISRA study, and he only knew of it from reading the VISRA study. He also admitted he wasn't a geneticist. He also admitted he had no training in genetics. He doesn't treat people for genetics. And in fact, he's never published anything on genetics. In fact, he's never published anything about this very topic. He's been at this for 11 years, opining that Benadryl causes birth defects. And you would think that someone who had that opinion would publish it in a scientific journal and have it peer-reviewed. He hasn't. And the particular opinion he expresses here is the first time that this interaction theory has ever been articulated. There's no support for it in any scientific literature. Not been peer-reviewed.
What then are we to make of all of the evidence that is cited to us in the reply brief and is part of the oral argument that was made by your learned friend?
Well, the Judge Tolliver founded his specific causation opinion on the basis that the opinion of the interaction theory, which is a theory being advanced now, requires a geneticist to say that there's some interaction to explain it. Dr. Howard merely said it. He really gave no plausible explanation for it. He gave no support. He readily admitted that it's never been published, never been peer-reviewed, never been tested by anybody.
So if we had a geneticist to say what Dr. Howard said, then you would agree that there would be support in the literature for that opinion, at least sufficient to make the issue.
If there was a geneticist who had articulated that interaction theory and had published it and peer-reviewed it, that would be a different case. That's not this case.
I'm sorry, not only would there have to be a geneticist to say it, but there also would have to be peer review studies?
He'd have to make, that same expert would have to meet the Daubert standards. And the reason for that is because, as I understand the reason for it, I think Justice Berger announced it, I think, in the Shoney case, the reason is you don't want experts coming into court and not exercising the intellectual rigor that they exercise in a scientific forum. You don't want them expressing scientific opinions to a Delaware jury that they wouldn't offer and haven't offered in a anything other than a litigation case.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand your position. If, in fact, Dr. Howard had been a geneticist, as well as having his other credentials, and articulated the same opinion that he did articulate here, that wouldn't be sufficient.
That wouldn't be sufficient unless that opinion had been published, peer-reviewed, and accepted some acceptance in at least a minority of the scientific community.
Published by someone qualified and peer-reviewed by someone qualified. And saying there is no such animal.
The current record is there is no such, and that's why Judge Tolliver's opinion on that issue should be upheld, because there's more than sufficient evidence and reasonable grounds for him to come to that conclusion.
So as I understand your challenge that Judge Tolliver agreed with, the first part is that this is beyond Dr. Howard's area of expertise. But even if it was within his area of expertise, there's no factual basis to support the opinion.
That's correct. He didn't provide any himself, and he cannot point to anyone else. In fact, interestingly enough, when he was being deposed by, I think it was Mr. Martinez, and was asked, well, he talked about a couple of instances where teratogens and genes have been associated to cause birth defects. And one is fetal alcohol syndrome, I can't remember the other two. And he said, well, what's the difference between a theory to that effect and proving it? He said, well, epidemiology, of course. Of course, the only evidence in this record is three epidemiological studies that don't show any connection between Benamil and birth defects.
Remind the court what, if any, correlation you're trying to make between the other two plaintiffs' experts who regrouped after this, you know, new science became available, and your contention that Dr. Howard shouldn't be able to render this opinion. Well, did he need those two people that regrouped?
I'm not sure who you're
As I understand it, there were three experts for the plaintiff, including Dr. Howard, and three of them looked at this CHD information, and two of them said, well, we agree now that this mutation is known. We're going to change our opinion, but yet Dr. Howard did not.
Well, Dr. Patton was the plaintiff's geneticist who, previous to the CHD7 studies, said he could not exclude genetics as a cause.
Right.
And when the CHD7 study was presented to him and he looked at it and was asked at his deposition, he said, well, it is a substantial cause, and then you can no longer rule it out as a cause. And that's what demolished the old opinion and gave rise to the new opinion.
So my question is, if Dr. Patton had adhered to his opinion, then perhaps that would have been a basis for Dr. Howard. But when Dr. Patton changed his mind, that pulled the props out from where Dr. Howard was going.
Yes, it did. And it's why he countered with this sort of new theory for which there's no basis in the record and no basis in the literature. My time is running low, and I'd like to get to Dr. McIntosh, because everyone agrees that in a court case such as this, you need to prove a dose sufficient to cause the effects. And you need to do it specifically. It's not something where there's a general connection between a substance and some effects or general effects. All the decisions that we've cited all reiterate that. And the Joyner case was example. The Supreme Court case in Joyner discussed that. And so you need to know how much. Now,
as we read your briefs, you basically said that for McIntosh to render an opinion, he had to quantify the degree of exposure. And once you make that determination, the rest of the equation kind of plays itself out. But that he was not qualified to quantify the amount of exposure.
Not only we didn't say that, he said it. He said, I'm not a qualified dermal absorption expert. I don't practice that. I don't know anything about it. Not a member of any society, never done it before, never been familiar with Benamil before. Dr. Sauerhoff, their former kineticist guy, who's also subject to a motion which wasn't decided, so we did challenge Tackett, we did challenge Sauerhoff, but even he said, yeah, you need to know how much is on the skin in order to find out how much gets through the skin. You also need to know how much gets metabolized and excreted before it gets to the fetus. And shockingly, in their briefs, the plaintiffs argue that, well, you can't do human study tests for this because it's just too dangerous. Well, guess what? In the Boone case, in which there was a stipulation, there's a stipulation in our record bringing all that discovery evidence into this record, and this case was delayed over a year while the human testing was done for use both in this case and the West Virginia cases. The plaintiff's attorneys at that time said, well, these are state-of-the-art studies, these Covan studies, and we need to have a year or so to develop some tests to refute that. So they did the tests. Human studies, human subjects, dermal absorption, pad at doses significantly greater than the ones that are here, and were kept on for 4 hours. And then the board decision discusses a lot of this. But the nub of it is, and the result of it is, at the end of it all, the person who did the study said, we couldn't find any quantifiable amounts of the metabolite that this guy says causes a birth defect. No quantifiable amount, which is also consistent with the animal studies that were pointed out in our briefing. So Judge Tollifer, again, was quite within his discretion to determine that Dr. McIntosh wasn't qualified to give a dose opinion. And
are these human studies you're talking about the ones that were initially not made known to the plaintiff's experts?
Well, they were made known. The plaintiff's attorney and the plaintiff's causal expert, Howard, had all these things. When they brought Dr. McIntosh on, they knew they couldn't use Dr. Howard's previous theories because he'd been bounced from West Virginia. Even faced with his own studies that showed no quantifiable measurement, he changed his tune and did some cockamamie calculation, which the West Virginia court said that's completely unreliable. It's result-oriented. Fourth Circuit affirmed. So did we get to Delaware? Well, they can't use that. What are they going to come up with? God forbid they should use a scientific study or a scientific data. They get Dr. McIntosh, keep him in the dark about all the studies that do exist, including their own human dermal absorption study, and rely upon a model which they know going in is used for not for the purposes of determining specific doses in specific people. It's used as a very gross risk assessment procedure by the EPA. And in fact, the EPA, when it requires companies like DuPont to register products, requires the kinds of studies which we point to. So the model he used is certainly within Judge Tolliver's discretion to find an unreliable model. It doesn't fit the facts of the case. I mean, the short answer is Dr. McIntosh is supposed to tell us how much. He doesn't know how much. He didn't even take the time to try and find out how much. Dr. Howard admitted that he didn't try to find out how much. He never did any studies, and we cite that testimony. He also testified that he was relying for dose and for dermal absorption entirely upon Dr. McIntosh. And yet Dr. McIntosh tells us he's not a dermal absorption expert. They'll tell us, well, he's a human exposure expert. All he did was look at the amount of skin, and that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When I start the clock, you'll see you have a little under 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Respectfully, I don't think we could have a better illustration of why this is all jury argument than what we've just heard. And I would respectfully request that you go back to the record and check on the factual representations which were made about their evidence and were made about our evidence. I want to get to McIntosh real quick. The question is not the litany of things which they say he didn't do. The question is what he did do. He did talk about exposure, and for absorption, he used the Potts-Guy model. So all of this devolves to their challenge to that model. They did not respond to my argument that that model is an accepted methodology. Once you get there under Daubert, you stop. The application of that methodology is for the jury. And the quantification that they don't think was done the right way was done through a model accepted by the governmental agencies that I listed to you and compared to actual real-life measurements. No response to that either. I've got to go to the main argument on charge. which, remember, concerns only Emily, only Emily, they admitted in response to a question that the CHARGE syndrome is not, the mutation is not necessarily the only cause. They say we didn't prove that there was a combination of causes in this case, and once again they cite the Visser study and say everything out there proves otherwise. I said the Visser study helps us. Not everyone who was exposed, not everyone who had the mutation in that study had the CHARGE symptoms. It was not sufficient. And there was no control in that study to find out what their environmental exposures were. It was an utterly useless exercise. If anything, it proved that there had to be a combination. Now, what did Dr. Heller do to establish that combination? That's what they need to be talking about, not how they think what they've done is better. He established an association in general between environmental and genetic causes. He established an association between environmental causes and genetic causes in relation to the CHARGE syndrome itself. He established that the evidence of a general correlation in this particular case, in Emily's case, was extremely weak.
And the argument, though, that we would like you to address, or I would like you to address, is that let's assume that that Dr. Howard had the necessary expertise to give the opinion that he did. We're told that even that is not sufficient under Daubert because that opinion needed to be the subject of some prior publication and peer review.
Well, that's been conceded. We have cited overwhelming evidence that a methodology doesn't have to be supported by peer review, doesn't have to be supported by any human testing. Human testing, incidentally, they're talking about was on males. It did get into the urine, and it established the extrapolation that in pregnant females there would be birth defects. So when they say, well, we did test humans, nobody would have the audacity to inject this stuff into a pregnant woman. These were tests on males, and that's all we could do, and we showed the concentration in urine which supported our thesis. And once again, we're talking about jury argument here. We're not talking about the minimum threshold. If POTSCI is established by all these governmental agencies and reports, then their quarrels about its application or about some other methodology they thought should be better should go to the jury. Dr. Howard, A, has training in genetics.
Your time is up.
Okay.
If you still think you're answering Justice Jacobs' question, you could continue. But I did want you to finish answering his question.
Unless Your Honor thinks that I've not completely answered it, I would be creating a fiction to use it as a threshold to just keep
on. I gather what you're saying is, number one, that there was no prior publication or peer review of the specific causation theory that's the subject of Dr. Howard's testimony, and two, as a legal matter, there doesn't have to be.
As a legal matter, there doesn't have to be, and as a factual matter, there doesn't have to be, given that our studies and their studies both showed that genetic factors are not sufficient. They don't result in the condition in every mutation. That has to prove our thesis, and with it, Dr. Howard's. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you all. The court appreciates your argument and the briefing. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.